My name's Alan. I'm an addict. That's probably one of the most profound things that I've ever said in my life. It was, it's the thing, and actually, and now that I have the job or the or whatever you want to call it that I have now, whenever they ask me to stand in front of a group of people and introduce myself, you know, with a tie and a suit and whatever, it's hard for me to stand up in front of everybody and go, my name's Alan, and stop there. You know, immediately what should follow for me is, and I'm an addict, because that's who I am and that's who I've always been. I don't spend a lot of time in addiction because I've been clean longer than I was loaded. Basically my addiction looks the same as everybody else's. It might not have happened in the same spot. It might not have happened in the same geographic location. Might not have been the same substance, but the horror and the darkness and the loneliness and the torture and the garbage that I went through is just the same as every other addict. I come from I'm not like one of those guys that was. I grew up on the mean streets of Eagle Point, Oregon. I bucked hay in the summertime. I went to rodeos. I had cowboy boots and a big belt buckle. I grew up on a farm. I had a dad who had a solid moral code. Like he knew morals and values, and that's where I learned most of my stuff. Like I did learn most of that. But also, for some reason, he didn't want me to have self-esteem or self-confidence. So what he did is he beat me down emotionally and physically and the whole works. And so I'm one of those people that, like, no matter where I'm at, like, I make the fucking best of it. Like, that's just who I am. Like, it doesn't matter if I was in jail or if I was in a penitentiary or if I was in a, it was as good as it was going to get, and I was okay there. I was going to get in where I fit in, and it didn't matter if I was in a garage with a bunch of tweakers or if I was hanging out in a house with a bunch of heroin addicts. It just didn't matter. You know what? It was as good as it was going to get. And still to this day, like, I still kind of live that way. No matter where I'm at, like, it is what it is, and I'm just going to make it through it. You know, I can sit and bitch about how horrible it is I'm just okay. So wherever I'm at, I'll make the best of it. I got clean, 5/12/96 is my clean date, and I had paroled, and I'm not one of those guys that, I didn't get to, put teardrops or spider webs on my elbows, but I always wanted to, because that's who I thought I was, that's who I thought I was going to be. Like, I thought, as soon as I got there, I thought, I met a lot of nice people there. I was like, fuck, this place is great. And I went when you could smoke. And so I went, and they had a fucking smoking cage, and I made minimum security, and so I just got to hang out, and I was at a work camp for a while. It was great. I just hung out with people who were just like me. I didn't have to worry. I didn't have to worry about a whole bunch of stuff. And I thought the whole time that I was in, I thought, what I'm going to do is when I get out of here, I'm just going to drink, and I'm not going to use methamphetamine, and I'm not going to go to the spoon, and I'm not going to use, I'm not going to take pills, and I'm not going to, I'm just going to drink and maybe smoke a little weed. I hate that. Like, that's not my thing. Drinking, it's just not my thing neither. I don't sit on a hot day and wish that I could drink beer. I hated it always. Always hated it. Did it because everybody else did it. When I got out, I thought that I was going to do this great thing, and I pulled from the hole because that's who I was. And I wasn't like me or like this badass or anything like that. But I accidentally liked shit on fire and. I saw allegedly a jacket caught on fire, and I have no recollection of it ever taking place, but they said that I did it, so I did it. I like to tell them no. I like to pretend I was hard in front of the fellas, and basically I did my last 8 days, and I thought that it would be all right, but I came out of that. I wrote myself a letter, and I remember the letter was the hole was a dark and scary place, and I was 20. I think I was 20 years old, and it was loud, and they didn't even give you a jumpsuit with a zipper. They gave you like, and they came and they took your sheets during the day, and so I mean, basically, man, it was treacherous. And I remember sitting in there, and actually it was one of the only times when I was in that I could just like sit and cry quietly, because that's who I really was. Like I was okay. I was okay when I was with people. I was all right. Like I could pretend like I was somebody else. But when I was alone, I was scared and nervous and fucked up and miserable. And so that's when feelings would hit, and I would go, okay, so when I get out of here, I'm not going to do that stuff. And as soon as I hit the street, and I was supposed to check in, and I was supposed to do all that stuff, I wasn't a check-in guy. I was a run until you got picked up again. And so I did that, and I did that twice, and it just so happened. I thought my parole for years. I thought my probation and parole officer, that all they wanted to do was keep me down. They wanted to keep me in the system, and I had one that when I got picked up, and I was rude. The last time that I was picked up, and I spit on him, and I called him names, and I told him all of the horrible things that you tell people that, you know, when you're really screwed and when you're not mentally okay, and he came and saw me like 2 days later, and all I could do was sit, and I cried, like I cried like snot bubble, like, you know, just woke up, you know, I'd been up for I don't know how many days, and I just got to sleep for a little while, and I woke up and I was emotionally, I don't know, I was pretty raw. And I cried and I told him I don't know what to do. I'm 21 years old and this is what I do. What I do is I get loaded and you pick me up and I get to be in jail for a little while and then I get out and I get loaded and you pick me up. And I said, I don't know how to have a job. I don't know how to have anything. My address was like care of or my state identification number after it. Like I remember laying in my bed just wishing that I could have an address one time where like a bill would come. I don't wish that anymore. But I remember just thinking, you know, if I could just have a spot, and I wish that I could call my dad one day and go, hey, you know what? I have a job, and I have a car, and I have a dog. And mail comes to this house now, and my parole officer, he used a personal favor and got me into a treatment center, and I'd never been to treatment before. I didn't know about Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know about any other 12-step program. And I can't say that I didn't know about it. I mean, I had heard about something somewhere, but it was mostly where a bunch of sissies sit around and talk about how they want to get fucked up, but they can't anymore. I was not going there because it just seemed lame to me, and those people were probably miserable. And I went to treatment, and it wasn't miserable, and the people from the fellowship were the people that worked at the treatment center, and there was a specific kind of person that I liked. All kinds of 12-step programs would come in and do their deal, and their H&I panels and have meetings. But the people that I was drawn to were the same people as me. I liked tattooed. I liked colorful. I liked language that was not becoming like regular society. I liked a little less on the manner side and a little more on the maybe psychotic, slightly schizophrenic side. You know, those were my people, and so I picked Narcotics Anonymous. Because it just seemed better. It just seemed like a better fit to me. It seemed more fun or what, but it just seemed like, man, that was my spot. Those were my people. And I sat in treatment for a little while, and I met this girl, right? And this is always the story, right? So I met this girl, and she had maybe 12 teeth total. And maybe four of them were black, but she was hard. She was this penitentiary girl, and I fell in love. I thought, man, she was everything that I had ever wanted. And basically after 30 days, her and I left treatment together, and we got to the end, and it was on a long driveway. And so you have to pack your shit out this driveway. And I thought, you know, we were going to run off into the sunset but as soon as I got to the end of the driveway, I knew that I'd fucked up. Like there was something wrong. Like I had gotten something in treatment from H&I coming in and from the people that worked there. Like I had been given like some sort of something, and I thought, you know, I've done the wrong thing. And there's this little store, and I called, and the first phone call I made was to the treatment center and said, hey, I might have fucked up. Do you think I can come back in 2 weeks? Because my plan was to get loaded for 2 weeks and then go back. They just seemed okay, and they said, yeah, if you stay clean for 24 hours, and they don't do that for people where I come from. You don't get to come back in 24 hours. They said, if you can stay clean for 24 hours, we'll let you come back. Because I had something. There was something that somebody identified in the treatment center. The lady who ran the treatment center, man, she was the greatest example of a recovering addict that I had ever met. And she loved me and loved me and loved me. And that was something that I needed. That was I got something from her that nobody else had ever given me. And I thought, like, no matter what I did, that lady knew I had something. And she said, yeah, come back in 24 hours. And so then my plan changed. Okay, so I'm not going to get loaded, but I am going to go to somewhere with this girl and do that whole deal. And her boyfriend pulled up, and we called him Biker Bob, and he had must have been like a Firebird, and it was a T-top, and you know he had a shaved head, and he was a member of Narcotics Anonymous, and I recognized him right out of the gate. He had a swastika tattooed on him somewhere, but that's not who he was, but that's who he was before he got clean. And she got in the car with him, and they sped off into the sunset. and I stood there with my bag, and I thought, okay, so, you know, and that's basically where I made the decision that I was going to do something different than what I had always done. And I stayed in Klamath Falls, and I was in a city called Klamath Falls, Oregon. And it was, I think, the beginning of October. And the beginning of October in Klamath Falls, Oregon, it's probably 30 degrees at night, maybe just down to 20, you know, into the 20s, and so I stayed down the street from the treatment center in a baseball field next to the train track. And luckily, when I left there, I stole all the towels that I could fit into my bag, and man, I sweat, and I put those towels, and I put all my clothes on, and I slept in that field so that I could go back in the morning and be clean and go back to treatment, because it was safe and warm, and people liked me there. 30 days later, I met this other girl. And she'd been there the whole time, and I just want you to know that this one ends a little different, because my then treatment girlfriend is still my treatment wife. And we left treatment together a little while later, and as soon as we got out, I ditched our bags in a ditch, and I called somebody from the other fellowship, but all I knew when I got out is that I needed to go to meetings. Like all of a sudden, like I just wanted to be part of the lame people who sat around and bitched about not getting loaded anymore. And I thought, okay, so I'll try this for a minute. If it keeps me out of jail, I'll try it. And I just wanted to shake my tail. Like I didn't get there and think, you know what, I want to have a good life. And I want to have, you know, I want to change everything about who I am. And I want to change, like, my behavior. And I don't want to be socially unacceptable anymore. No, when I got here, I thought, you know, if I can just get off parole, I'll be all right. If I just got off probation, I'll be all right. But somewhere that changed for me, and I can't remember exactly when it was. But she had two kids, and so I went from the penitentiary to treatment to a girlfriend with two kids that weren't mine, and I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know how to do it, and I had no tools to get through it. I didn't know how to be employed. I didn't know how to be a father. I didn't know how to be a stepfather. I didn't know how to be a role model. I didn't know how to be shit. But I had some sort of a moral code that my dad gave me. And then the only other thing I had was Narcotics Anonymous. Like that was it. That was what I started with. So I started with a duffel bag of hooked up missing girlfriend who was in the relationship part, and I won't even get into that. You know, it's hard enough being an addict trying to stay clean, but trying to be with an addict trying to stay clean, and then with two kids that I never wanted to start with, and it sounds harsh, but it is what it is. And then she shows up to a meeting, we're getting ready to go in, and she goes, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. And I was like, oh, well, who is it? So person, you know, really been with. Because it's not mine, because I'm not capable of being a parent. I'm not capable of, like, no, there's no way that's not mine. And so when I sat in that meeting, and the funniest thing happened is that I thought to myself, you know what, I've got to do something different, so I guess I'll get a job, and I guess I'll get a place to live, and I guess I'll just raise these other two kids that aren't mine, and I guess it's just time to accept, like, the whole deal. Okay, so acceptance, and so now what do I do? So I'm telling you that the first few months was, like, harsh, and the more pregnant she got, the worse she was. It was almost unlivable, but I'll tell you what I did is I went to meetings every day, and I didn't have a car, and I didn't have a driver's license, and I didn't have, but I had a job, and so I would walk to work, and as soon as I would get out, and I worked in a steel yard, and as soon as I got off work, I'd go home, and I'd take a cold shower because we couldn't afford hot water, and we would cook on an electric skillet because we couldn't afford gas for the stove either. And so we would cook like on it, and we didn't have a lot of food. And what I would do is I would call somebody from the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and I would go, hey, can I have a regular meeting? And there was a guy who lived right down the street, and he would pick us up every day. And I'd go to a meeting, and then I didn't care where I went to. In Klamath Falls, Oregon, that's a small town also, and so when there wasn't a meeting on Tuesday or on Thursday, then you went wherever you needed to go to get whatever you needed to get. Okay. I knew that I didn't belong there, but I knew that it was better than, like, sitting at home with that, sitting at home with Psycho. I don't know how long it was before I got a sponsor, but I was working, I had gotten a second job after that one, or maybe it was just right before that, but we were working with Lacquer Center at and I was working with a bunch of addicts, and I started working with Lacquer Center, and my day would go by pretty decent. Like, you know, we were wiping down, we were installing countertops, and the, man, the more I worked with Lacquer Center, the better my day got. And I was about 9 months clean, and I know that I was exactly 9 months clean. And I had started picking up newcomers right when, to sleep on my couch, like right when we got clean. And so I picked up this guy that I had gotten loaded with for, like, my entire life, and he was living on my couch. And pretty soon, I was coming home and I had a 44-ounce Big Gulp cup with a Lacquer Center soaked rag in the bottom of that, because I didn't have a problem with Lacquer Center, right? That wasn't a drug. That's not a drug. At 9 months, I didn't tell anybody about it. But my wife would go, how come you smell like, how come your mouth smells like Lacquer? And, well, we work with Lacquer Center at work. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. But, you know, and so pretty soon I'm driving around in my truck with this newcomer that I picked up, and I got my face in a fucking, I'm getting loaded on Lacquer Center. And so I thought, man, you know, this isn't working out, so I should probably just be a recreational drinker also. So I recreationally drank for like 4 hours. And then I was a recreational drunk driver. And then I thought, well, you know, this isn't working out, so I'll use whatever else. I took some bong hits, and I thought I'll be a recreational weed smoker. And that combination makes me sick. And so then there's my drug of choice that seems to bring me back to a dark garage with holes drilled in the garage door so that I can see outside to make sure nobody's sneaking up on me. And I did that recreationally for about 4 days. And maybe it was only a couple of days, but either way, I figured out then, and when I got back, and so I left home, and I think it was Mother's Day, because I was going over to see my mom, and I never made it to my mom's house, and I ended up in a garage somewhere shooting dope. It was the same deal with the same people that I used with 9 months previous, and so when I came back, I told my wife, I said, hey, I think I'm a recreational drinker, and she was my girlfriend then still, and she was very pregnant, and I said, so let's stop at the store and we'll buy 240. And she said, recreational drinkers don't drink 40-ounce malt liquor. And I was like, oh. And she said, there's something wrong with you. You're fucked up. And we need to go to a meeting. And I was like, I'm not going back to meetings. Just so you know, I got loaded. I've been loaded for a few days, and I'm not going back to a meeting. because I don't want to be judged and I don't want people to hate me, and I've done everything that I wasn't supposed to do that you guys taught me not to do. I did everything that I wasn't supposed to do, so I'm not going back there because I'm guilt and shame, right? That's my entire life has been guilt and shame. That's how my parents controlled me. That's how I make myself feel. And so I wasn't going back to meetings because you guys were gonna call me names, and it was just gonna be weird. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. And it took me a couple of weeks, but there was this guy, his name was Danny. And actually, Lori, he was married to the lady who helped me in treatment. And he was one of those bikers, and he had like this handlebar mustache that came down to like here, and he wrote a Harley Davidson, he had tattoos all over, and San Quentin like tattoos, like skulls and demons and castles and naked ladies, and I was like extremely. But when he opened his mouth in a meeting, like this thing would happen. Like he looked hard, but he wasn't hard. He was like soft and gentle, and he had probably maybe 5 or 6 years clean then, and I thought, man, you know what, that's what I want. That's what I would like to have. And he came, and he rescued me. He came and he said, hey, let's go to a meeting, and I started going to meetings, and I picked him as my sponsor, and he didn't make me work steps, he didn't do anything. What he did is he let me sleep on his couch, and when I had a relationship problem, I would go to his house, and when my kid was born, I would take my kid over there, and we would set him in front of the fish tank, and we would talk about literature, and we would talk about program, and we would talk about how my life was going to be different if I continued to do the things that I was supposed to do, the things that they taught me in Narcotics Anonymous. If I did that, then my life would get better. He didn't necessarily tell me that it would get better for a little while, and then it would get really hard, and then it would get better for a little while, and then it would get really hard again. He didn't tell me about the really hard parts. And he didn't make me work steps, and so I missed out on that part. And he was my sponsor for a little while. I got a better job, and finally I worked for a manufacturing company, and they paid for all of my school because I'll tell you that I was the guy I worked in a manufacturing plant, so I fit right in, and I was the guy that if a manager told me what to do, I'd tell them to go fuck themselves, and they wouldn't do anything to me because I was obsessive compulsive to the point where I kept everything clean, I kept everything neat and tidy and organized, and I worked and worked and worked, and so they wouldn't do anything to me. But pretty soon they identified something in me that I'd never seen before, and they said, you know what, you're somebody, and we want to send you to school to see if we can make that happen. I was the guy that walked like, if I had a hole in my pants, I'd pull a ball out. You know what I mean? And walk around, and I had cut off sleeves on my shirt, and you know, I just was who I was, and if you didn't like it, fuck you. And that's who I was when I got clean. I took pride in that. I also took pride in the fact that I was an addict in recovery. And I would tell people that, hey, you know what? I go to 12-step meetings, and if you want to get clean, I know how to get clean. Like, I wasn't a great example of like what happened to you when you got clean, but also I was 22 or 23 years old. So I mean, I wasn't even a full-grown man yet. I was still like, you know, however old you are when you're still stupid until you're 25. And actually, I'm 39, and I still have a little bit of that. So I had this job that gave me a chance, and then I had surrounded myself with people who continued to teach me new things. I had a lot of stuff, when I first got here, I thought what I needed to do, when you come from a small area, what I needed to do was purify Narcotics Anonymous, and so I went on this trek and this mission to eliminate all other forms of recovery from meetings in the entire world. So I went on this thing where, you know, they called me all kinds of names, but I was passionate. I like to call it passionate about Narcotics Anonymous. They call it something completely different, but I spent a lot of time like trying to bring basic texts and literature, and if you shared about something that you weren't supposed to share about, I was the guy, right? Like I felt I don't know what you call it, righteous indignation, right? And so what I would do is I wait till after the meeting, or sometimes I just pipe up right in the middle of the meeting and go, hey motherfucker, you can't talk about that here. And people would go, what? And I go, yeah, you can't talk about religion or any other program, and if you don't like it, get out. I walk into it, like, I don't know, that's just who I thought that I needed to be. And nobody told me that I had to leave. Nobody said, hey, you're not welcome here. Nobody ever told me that what they did do, though, is they would wait till after the meeting, and they would tell me, hey, our job is to keep people here. Our job isn't to, like, push people out. And when you do that, it doesn't look good. It doesn't feel good, and it makes everybody uncomfortable. And, of course, I told them to fuck themselves and offered to maybe fist fight in the parking lot if they wanted to take it farther. But luckily, I didn't get beat up or stabbed or, because you find those newcomers in need. And coming from Southern California, because I lived there for 6 years, coming from Southern California, I mean, you don't get away with it. You might get shanked in the meeting. If you were to try to do something like that. Even here, I'm a little uncomfortable. I was sitting out in my car, and all you guys were pulling up, and there was, like, carloads and carloads, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of Mexicans here, too. Okay, make the adjustment. Don't show like a white guy. And then I was happy that nobody else was here because I can lie as much as I want and not have anybody call me out. No, really, I was hard. I was a gangster. No, that's not the case. I don't know exactly when everything changed into. I remember when I got a year, I got that metal chip, and it was the most proud moment of my life. And I called my mom, and I called my dad, and I called everybody, because I had gotten for the first time in my life a metal chip, and I had 1 year with nothing in my system. And I thought, you know what? If things aren't, I wasn't sold on the whole thing where I wanted to do this always. I'm like, so wait, what you guys are fucking telling me is that I have to go here for the rest of my life because I have some sort of a disease where I can never, like, socially drink ever again? Okay, well, I'm not buying it yet. So in 2 years, if I don't have everything that I want, I'm going to get loaded. Right? Because I had a guy tell me that. He said, if you don't like it, you can always get loaded, and you can always come back, but sometimes you die. I was like, that sounds happy. So I stayed for, like, 2 years. And I thought, okay, well, And the whole time I'm learning things, and the whole time, like, my job is, like, continuing to give me, like, responsibility, and the whole time, like, I'm evolving into, like, a real person, and where like, I fill out tax forms, and I used to do that all by myself, right? Like, that was a fucking big deal. Nobody showed me how to do that when I was a kid. Nobody showed me how to balance a checkbook. I'm not good at that still. But nobody showed me how to do, like, a lot of stuff that I was, like, doing, if I didn't know how to balance my checkbook, I would call my friend and go, hey, what do I do? And he would go, come bring it over. I'll show you. And then I would have a problem with two kids that weren't mine and a crying baby, and I'd go, hey, I don't know what to do. Like, and he'd go, come over. And I'd go, hey, I got a wife, and she's fucked up, and she won't work the steps the way that I think that she should. What do I do? And he would say, well, come over, and you can bring her, and maybe my wife will talk to her. All right, that seems good. So the whole time I had all of these problems, my solution wasn't to call my parents, and my solution wasn't to, like, do, like, whatever I was supposed to do. My solution was to call the people in Narcotics Anonymous who had something that I didn't know how to do, or to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so it was a long and sometimes hard journey. I went through probably at 7 years clean. I had an affair with this girl that actually she was my employee. We worked together for a long time, and I rode to work with her for a long time, and I crossed some lines that you're not supposed to cross if you're married, and I didn't know it. I mean, I kind of knew. I kind of had an idea, like, when it was happening, that I shouldn't share, like, and I was sharing, like, deep, like, stuff that I shouldn't share with anybody but I guess it's stuff that I should have shared with the people in Narcotics Anonymous, like men in Narcotics Anonymous, never with a woman. And what happened was, so I did this thing, and it was on my wife's, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking, but it was on her recovery birthday, I don't know, maybe 2 days before she was going to get a chip. And I had 7 years, and I think she probably had 8 years. And and I was going to this NA event. I was working graveyard, and I was running a crew, and I ended up having had sex with this girl. And as soon as it was over, right before I wanted to sleep, that feeling of guilt and that feeling of shame and that feeling of like a whole bunch of feelings that I hadn't experienced since I was loaded or since I was a kid or since like all of a sudden like I had all of these, man, it was bad. Not only that, but everybody in my circle of friends, like all of my people and all of, like my sponsor knew about it, my sponsees knew about it, because I was trying to not have this affair while I was having the affair. Like it was that addiction piece, you know, it's that spot where you go, oh wait, I'm not just addicted to mind-altering, mood-changing substances. I'm also addicted to jerking off, porn, PlayStation, women that I'm not supposed to be with. Anything that makes me feel different than who I am. What you mean is I'm fucking addicted to that? That's scary. But all of a sudden, I can lose like a whole like I lost a whole 6 months right there. I don't know what I was doing. I don't know. I wasn't openly sharing about it at meetings, but I was sharing with like my sponsee and my and all my friends. And not only that, but my wife and I had done this whole thing together. So not only were everybody was my friend, but everybody was her friend also. So basically, when the shit does hit the fan, so basically what's going to happen is every one of my sponsees and my sponsor and all of our friends are going to tell her that, hey, for the last 6 months we've known that your husband is had or was going to fuck this girl, right? And so now she's not only that, but my friends are carrying around all of this guilt. So basically what I did is by having a secret and sharing my secret and having them hold a secret, then all of a sudden we're all sick and we're all fucked up. And we're all in this thing. And so the ones that don't want to, you know, it was just a bad deal. And it was as close as I've ever been to getting loaded. And I can't even tell you how, I can't even tell you how like painful it was. It was like horribly. Every day I would call somebody on my way home from work and talk to them so that I didn't stop at a store and get loaded, because that's the easiest way for me to start my addiction is with whatever is available. And not only that, but she also she was fucked up too. She was more. She was like, well, I mean, she was a little bit fucked up too. She was 10 times more fucked up than I was.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, I had no idea, like, when I did this, I had this thing made up in my head that it wasn't going to hurt her that badly, and, like, we were just going to get over it and just move on, but that's not the case. Like, man, it cut her so deep because I was the guy, like, I was this guy in her eyes that would never do that. I worked a program, I worked steps, I had a sponsor, I did the right thing, you know, at 7 years clean, I had this whole thing pretty well mapped out. Like, I was good. Like, I was kind, and that, well, I mean, I wasn't always kind, but, you know, I was on the path to being who I always wanted to be. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't. And so it shatters this whole thing with her, and it shatters this whole thing with me, and then the only thing that I knew how to do was to go to meetings and sit at meetings and cry about it. And go, man, I'm fucked up, and this is why I'm fucked up. And so I did that for her, and I didn't even care. I don't care. Like, right now, I stand up here with 17 years clean, and I'm still fucked up. Like, I still have horrible, like, I still have bad, 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 bad days. And most of that's because I have a 16-year-old son who's an addict. And that's difficult for me. But this whole thing happened, and I go, okay, so what am I supposed to do? And what I did is I just went back to what I knew how to do. Like, and I had this whole normal life thing happening at work because I was supposed to be this person at work, and then I had this whole being an addict thing happening in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and then I had this whole thing that was broken at home, and it was probably one of the most difficult times. And some people go, well, it doesn't seem that difficult because I've been through death and I've been through like whatever. But I'll tell you, man, I don't know. The only way that I made it through it was I surrounded myself with the people that could help me, and I came completely and totally clean, and I did the whole deal where And we got outside help. And that's something that also that I've done since I've been clean, is I have a relationship with somebody who's as fucked up as I am. And so we always go see a marriage counselor, and it doesn't. And most of the time, it's so we can give her a little tune-up and get her back on track. I do appreciate that part. Even when I say it, it sounds fun. Since we've been together, that's just what we've done, and we spent probably 6 months in counseling on that whole deal. And so, I decided to move, and I worked for the same company for 10 years, and they gave me all these great tools, and they gave me all this great schooling, and they did. And so I moved to Southern California. So for the first time in my life, I was clean for 12 years in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And that's like 36,000 people, 7 meetings a week, and all of them were my home group because there was only 7 meetings anywhere. And ever since I've been clean, I've done hospitals and institutions. And ever since I got clean, I've had a newcomer on my couch. That's just as sometimes I had 3 kids, 2 dogs, and 4 newcomers. And 2 ferrets and a hedgehog. It was just crazy, and I had a 1,200 square foot house, and so you had all of this shit going on. And my kid grew up. My 16-year-old grew up on his 3rd day of life. He was in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and he's been raised in Narcotics Anonymous. But he got the gene, and he missed the message. which is unfortunate. I'm not exactly sure how I got to where I'm at today, clean, with the exception of that I just continued to go to meetings, and I just continued to, and I have to be, I'm completely honest, I just finished working the 12 steps from start to finish with my sponsor, and I think I finished probably 11 months ago. You know, so I made it this whole time where I would work 1 through 6 and then get a new sponsor, and 1 through 6 and get a new sponsor, and 1 through 6 and get a new sponsor. But I finally had the same sponsor long enough where I was able to work all 12 of them. And he lived in Southern California. When I moved to Southern California, I walked in and I had 12 years clean. And when I walked into the first meeting and sat down, it wasn't right where I came from. It was big. It was Orange County. And so, and I walked in, and it was really a different feeling. I thought, these aren't my people. And I did that for probably 6 months. Just kind of went, kind of hit and miss. And not even hit and miss. Like, I would go to one and then wait for a month and then go to another one and not like that. And then go to another one and not like that. And it was, finally, I've gone to a meeting where they hugged me and they loved me and they invited us out for coffee. And so, and I made that my home group. And then from there, I went to Monterey Park with my sponsor. And I'll tell you that's where I met my people. Like, I walked in for the first time in Monterey Park, and I looked around the room and I thought, fuck this. Like, it was bigger than some of the conventions where I was from. Like, it was a lot of dudes, and there were tattoos on the neck and tattoos over the eye, right? You know what I mean? Like, there were a lot of, like, and I thought, man, these guys, there's no way I'm going to be accepted here. Not only that, but I was brought by a guy they call Surfer Jim, Jim D, and he was my sponsor, and we rode up with another guy named Joe, and he was white, and Jim is white, and we sat on like this one side of the, and there was another guy named Skip, and he rode a motorcycle, and he didn't tell me all these guys, but and so when we would walk in, and there would be all the wood piles here. And I was like, man, tough crowd, and it was almost like I didn't want to be associated with the white guys, but I was a white guy. Like, as soon as I opened my mouth, they knew that, oh, there's a white guy. It was stupid and crazy, but that's who I am, right? When I walk into a room, I know what everybody's thinking. Yeah, I immediately turn into a mind reader. On my way down here, I brought two shirts. I brought one with no sleeves, and I brought a button up. And that was just in case I wanted to change, like, how I was feeling, I could change my shirt. That was just in case I walked into the room and everybody thought, look at that guy with a fucking button-up shirt on. That's stupid. but to me, that's what everybody thinks, right? But when I get comfortable, like, I'm okay. Like, I'll expose, like, I'm transparent. Like, I don't do quiet and, like, don't tell people who you are very good at all. Because that's not the way that Narcotics Anonymous has always shown me how to be. Like, how I've been taught to be since I got here was to share who I am. And I understand, like, the anonymity thing. I have this job where I show up every day and I have a tie, and my shirt rubs my neck raw, and I deal with it. And I don't share who I am in board meetings, and I don't share who I am with investors, and I don't share unless I have an opportunity. Right? My boss hates it. Jimmy's the meeting. Bobby's my friend. I'm a friend of Bobby. But when I have an opportunity to share with them who I am, my boss is a bank robber. He was a bank robber when I met him. He was 19. He was a newcomer. I went to his house every day before he went to a federal prison. At 19 years old, every day to take him to a meeting or take him to a camp out or take him to some recovery-oriented event. And then he went to prison, and I drove 12 hours. And I wasn't a sponsor. I was just his friend. And so every day, and his parents loved us. And he loved us. And when shit got hard for me in Southern California, and I ran into a health problem, and my kidneys, I have bad kidneys. I tried to donate a kidney, and both my kidneys are bad. And so I needed health insurance, and I needed all this stuff. And so I moved to Sacramento because this guy gave me an opportunity, right? So here's a newcomer that I helped out 16 years ago or 15 years ago who was a bank robber who has this gigantic company now, and he makes a shitload of money, and he doesn't pay me enough. But he doesn't pay me enough, and he's kind of an asshole. And that's not who he was when he was 19 years old, right? He was working a program, and he was doing all the right things, and he got out of prison, and because of what Narcotics Anonymous showed him, he was able to build this life. But what he did is he got his, and he left, right? Like, so that's who he is. And so basically all of these years later, I called him and said, I need some money, and he said, hey, I'll give you a job. I'll send you the money, but if you want, I'll give you a job. And I said, okay, so I moved to Sacramento, and so I went from one area where I was really comfortable. I went to another area where I wasn't so comfortable, and I thought that everybody was going to judge me. And then I went to Los Angeles. I don't even know what area that is, but Monterey Park. And I started hanging out with those guys, and those guys come from all over the place, right? So like I can go to that meeting and meet people all the way from Washington, all the way from back east, like people who are like kind of regular. Like whenever they come back, they go there. And it's amazing to me. And so I walked in, and that's where I got the love. Like, I was anti-men's SAG meetings before I moved to Southern California. I was anti-special interest groups. Like, I the way I stated it, like, young people's fucking meetings. When I first got clean, there wasn't a young person's meeting because there were really not a lot of young people in my area. And now when I go to young people's meetings, it's not young people anyway. It's a bunch of... This is old people. And so, bunch of brothers. So when I got clean, like I didn't surround myself with young people, and I didn't surround myself with men, and I didn't surround myself with, I wasn't a special interest person, but when I showed up to the men's SAG meeting, I was like, oh wait, I get it. So I can talk about anything that I need to talk about. Like, I don't show up and bitch about my wife, and that's not what it's about. But if I want to talk about stuff that's specific, then I have a whole room. If I want to talk about how much I love my mom and dad, but I don't do enough, if I want to talk about feelings, like that deep, like gut level, like feeling shit, if I want to cry and like snot bubbles and then I sit in a room with a bunch of people who look a certain way, but they feel a certain way. Like they can feel how I feel. Like they know who I am. When I say that I'm insecure, neurotic, and emotional, I sit in a room with a bunch of people who look like they're not, but who that's how they feel, right? It was amazing to me the love and support that I got in the room, and it was amazing to me the love and support. And even now, when I go back, like I went to that thing in April, and I'll tell you that those guys, they missed me. And I thought that I was like the white guy from Orange County, and but I sat in that room for like a few years, you know. It's another one of those situations where what place can I go where I feel a certain way, or where nobody likes me, or where I can be at the lowest point in my life and the biggest piece of shit. I can come in with track marks. I can come in with a criminal record. I can come in with multiple felonies. I can come in straight out of prison. I can come in straight off of the street. I can come in homeless. I can come in broken, battered, and not have anywhere to fucking go. But I can come into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and people will hug me, and people will tell me that they love me, and people will help me through like whatever I'm going through. And not only that, but when I leave, they tell me, come back. And where I come from, that's not what they used to tell me. They used to tell me, hey, you can't hang out here anymore. Hey, you're too fucked up. Hey, whenever the cops stop by, you're the one that gets us all arrested. Like, you're not allowed. In Narcotics Anonymous, they never did that to me. And they never said, hey, stop crying, you sissy. They never said, you know, a man is a man, and you're supposed to act a certain way, and you're supposed to do a certain thing. They never put a bunch of shit on me. They said, you can be who you want to be, and this is what we suggest, but if you don't want to do that, it's fine. Just keep hanging out. And that's what I truly love about Narcotics Anonymous. And so here I am all of this time down the road, and I've moved from Oregon to Los Angeles to Orange County, and then from Orange County to Sacramento. I love Orange County. I like Los Angeles. I like the big city. I like smog. I like people, and I like the beach. And now I'm in Sacramento, and the beach is a stretch. And the fellowship is good, but I'll tell you that this is the most comfortable that I've felt since April. You know, I walk into meetings there, and people ask me to share, and like I do that whole deal, but I don't really like them. And I still have that thing where like I'm different than you are, and you're different than I am, and I really don't want to expose myself because I really don't want to get locked into some fucking thing. I don't want to have to go to meetings. I don't want people to call me and go, hey, where are you at? We haven't seen you for a few days. I want that to happen. I mean, that'd be horrible. You know, so there's part of me, like, with this job that I have and with the boss that I have that wants me to not expose myself. Like, it's like this constant moral battle for me. Like, I know who I am and I know who I want to be. Like, the most centered and the most, like, when I feel the very best, that's when I'm here. I feel the best when I have a newcomer on my couch. I feel the best when I get up every morning and I read Narcotics Anonymous literature. And at night I pray, and I look in the directory to find a meeting that I want to go to. That's where I operate the best. But man, it's been difficult. So I've been there for like 9 or 10 months, and I'm pretty well plugged in. Like I'm okay. Just that I don't call those people. I still call Southern California. I still call Oregon, and I have a friend that I call in Arkansas. You know, I don't use a support group that's close to me, which, I mean, I could end up loaded over that, you know, if I want to get honest about it. Like, if I really want to be really honest and go, am I doing everything that I should do? Am I an active member of Narcotics Anonymous? Mm-mm. Do I have a service position? Nope. Do I do H&I? H&I kept me clean for years. Am I doing that? Uh-uh. Am I working steps? Nope. Do I call my sponsor? Mm-mm. Do I call people in recovery? Yeah. Do I read literature? Yeah. Is that enough? Fuck no, I'm going to get loaded. Like, I'll stand up here right now and tell you, I'm one horrible feeling away from losing everything that I got. Because when I go, I'm pretty sure it's 17 years when you go off the fucking deep end. Like, it's not easy to come back because I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with 24 years clean and the deep end and the struggle to, like, maintain. Like, so I'm pretty sure that if I continue to go the way I'm going, fucked. It's simple for me. what's my long-term plan? Like, yeah, I have talked to the guy from H&I. And when is the meeting? Well, the meeting's today. The H&I meeting is today. So I have to escape one more. Well, I have to escape for one more month that I don't, like, I don't have to do what I'm really good at. Which is, they told me when I got here, because I still go through this, like, what's my purpose? And my third sponsor told me, and he was hardcore Narcotics Anonymous, and I said, what's my purpose? Like, am I a father? Am I a son? Am I a, and he said, no, you're all of that stuff, but your main purpose is to remain clean and carry the message to the addict who still suffers. And if I'm not doing that, I'm burnt. Like, I know that that's my purpose. I know that's what I'm supposed to do, but what keeps me from doing it? I'll share a little bit about my little struggle. How much time do I have, Bobby? Okay. I'll share real quick about where I'm at right now, and this is the part that's gonna get and it's already sad. I have a 16-year-old son who was raised here. And he loves newcomers. Like, I would bring a newcomer home, and he would be the kid. Like, I would bring a heroin addict home who would be kicking, and he was the kid that would bring him some candy. And like, he knew, right? He knows. Like, he knows what heroin addicts need when they kick. My kid is the kid who, like, and I have two older boys also, and a grandkid. My kids know, like, they've been raised here. So they know all about the disease of addiction, and they know all about what it takes to get clean, and they know what withdrawal looks like. They know what DTs look like, because we've done that as a family. We've done that. It's the weirdest fucking thing, and people think I'm nuts, but that basically that's what we've done. And I have a kid who fucking smokes weed, and he hasn't like for the last couple of months, but. 4 weeks ago, he overdosed on lorazepam that was left out by my mother-in-law. A few days later, he got picked up for shoplifting at Walmart. And I also, I got another kid from Orange County who's my kid's best friend. And a lot of people go, you're fucking crazy for doing that. It's a kid who doesn't have a family. He doesn't have a support group. He doesn't have anybody. And so I took him in, and I got power of attorney and all of that shit, and I help him go to school, and I help him do all this. He's like a 6'2" black kid, and when they got arrested, the cops, he's got an attitude problem, and he's difficult for anybody to handle, but there's something about me that he is drawn to, that he gravitates to, and when I showed up, he was completely done, and he cried, and he was sorry. You know what I mean? And so basically, I'm trying to save that kid, and I'm trying to save my kid at the same time, and I don't know how to fucking do it. I'll tell you that I can carry the message to the addict who still suffers, but it's really difficult when it's your kid. Right now, it's probably the most difficult and most trying situation as far as like what to do next. Like, do I take him to treatment and drop 10 grand on letting somebody else try to fucking deal with the problem? I know that's not the answer. Right, so here's the answer. When I was a kid, my parents did a lot of shit. You know, they beat me, they kicked me, they sent me to treatment centers, they boys' ranches, and they let me get arrested, and they did that whole deal, and they tried to help me. They did the very best they could. And so, and here's where I'm at. I have a kid who smokes weed, he steals, he lies, he cheats, but you know what? He's never disrespectful. And he's never mean, and he's never rude, and he still hugs me, and he still tells me I love you, and I'm always afraid that I'm going to wake up, and he's going to be blue in his bedroom because he did something stupid. They have all kinds of shit out now. They have, stuff that you can buy at the head shop and get fucked up on. They have shit that you put in a fucking bathtub that makes you fucking nuts. They have all kinds of random shit, and I'm afraid my kid's going to die. And my kid was the first one to show me that I felt unconditional love for. Like, no matter what that fucking kid does, you know what, I love him and he loves me. And it's difficult. And it's scary, and it's fucking hard, and it tears my relationship apart. Like, you know, my wife is like, no, we need to put him in treatment. And I'm like, no, if he's an addict, we just got to let him go be an addict. And what we need to do is just prepare for the worst, because here's the deal. Like, nowadays, heroin addicts don't make it the way that they used to make it. Like, anybody in the room who knows that addiction, it's not like it was. And not only that, but my kid is 16 years old, and there's something about, like, that generation that doesn't know moderation. So instead of taking, like, a couple of lorazepam, he took five. And they were the fucking, like my mother-in-law's a dope fiend. Like, she has a pill that takes her up, and she has a pill that brings her down when it's time, and she has a pill that fucking makes her eat lunch, and she has, like, she's fucked up. And so her pills are, like, big bottles of pills, and there's a lot of them. And so, and the other kid, he took some pills too, but he something happened with him. There was moderation. And so the only thing that I knew, the only thing that I hadn't tried yet was what my dad tried for years, and that's beat the piss out of him. And so I tried it. Well, guess what? That ended up the same way. It ended up with guilt and shame and treachery and a whole bunch of remorse and whatever. And so basically what I have to do now is I have to figure out how to be an addict and stay clean and also do what I've done with every other newcomer. And that's let them stay in my house for as long as they can without them, like, disrespecting my home. And then at some point I have to go, you know what? You got to fucking go. And then I have to send my kid to the street so that he can be a fucking liar, a cheat, and a thief. And I have to send him to the street so they can maybe end up in jail or in prison or fucking with blue lips and a needle fucking hanging out of his arm. Or give him fucking $5 blowjobs at a Greyhound station. It is what it is. And so, and I share that, and I share it with him. I go, you know what? Remember Rusty? Remember Keith? Remember Gary? Remember fucking Jimmy? Remember, like, all of the newcomers that have come to the house? Remember those guys? That's where you're going. And so at some point, or somehow, some way, I have to figure out how to get through that. Right? And I have to figure out how to help my wife through it, and she has to figure out how to help me through it. Because I'm not going to go spend $5,000, because the kid is just going to be a dope fiend if he's a dope fiend. And he has to run that fucking thing all the way to the bitter end if that's how he's going to roll. And he's got to come up with some serious coping skills because he's been pretty sheltered. Like, if he needs something, he comes and he goes, hey, Dad, can I have $10? And I go, for what? Where are you going and bring me a fucking receipt? To, if he needs $10, he's going to have to go light, shoot, and steal for it. Like my wife said, and I let him smoke cigarettes, too. I'm like, there's a shining moment in my life right there. To watch my 16-year-old fucking go out on the back porch and fucking smoke a cigarette and look like a fucking complete moron. But guess what? I was the same complete moron. I was the same one that was stupid when I smoked what I thought it was cool. And man, it's the same. And so, and here's what I hope. And I'll close with this. I hope that before he dies, or before he goes to jail, or before he goes to prison, or before he cops some felony, I hope that he wanders into this room right here. And I hope that you fucking people are the ones that he fucking is exposed to. And I hope that you're the ones that fucking hug him and tell him that you love him and tell him that there's a different way to fucking do it and there's a better way to live. And the only way to do that is through Narcotics Anonymous, with a sponsor, with steps, with literature, and with a service position. And you know what? If you do that for me, and you do it for him, and I'm winning. And that's what Narcotics Anonymous has given me. It's given me a solution. And it's given me hope that, you know what, when my kid needs it, you'll be here for him. Thanks for letting me share. Yeah.